Genesis 48-50, the 44th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 9, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
In this section, Jacob is going to make his final arrangements. He's on the deathbed, and he knows that, and he proclaims some blessings on all of his sons. And then he dies and is buried, and that's what we'll be going through. This is my last week on Genesis, and I left too much for 1 hour. But I think I found a way that we can make our way through it. This section has more textual problems than any section of the Bible that I have encountered. They are big textual problems, very significant textual problems, and I did not have the time, nor do I even have the knowledge to sort through all of that stuff. So I am relying heavily on what the commentaries have done for me with respect to these. And so there are a number of places where I will be reading things that you won't find in your Bible, that these are reconstructions that other people have come up with. So just keep that in mind. There are a gazillion questions that could be raised about this passage that I didn't have time to get into. So I'm just going to, as best I can, make our way through these last three chapters. So Genesis 48, we'll do 1-7 to start with. Now it came about after these things that Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is sick." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. When it was told to Jacob, "Behold, your son Joseph has come to you," Israel collected his strength and sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And he said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. But your offspring that have been born after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the names of their brothers in their inheritance. Now as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died to my sorrow in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem." Okay, so Jacob is coming to the end of his days. He knows that he's coming to the end of his days. Joseph, who has been an administrator in the administration of the Pharaoh, apparently is living apart from Jacob and his family in Goshen. He is apparently living back in Egypt. And it appears as though Joseph has been monitoring Jacob's progress closely. And it comes to the time when Jacob's about to die. Joseph receives word of that, and Joseph goes to be with Jacob, and he takes his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And they go to see Jacob, and I think what's happening here is verses 3-7 are recounting a past event. And that could be translated, Jacob had said to Joseph something that had already occurred. And what it goes on to describe is Jacob adopting two of Joseph's sons as his own. And then that's going to be followed by a blessing that's proclaimed on Ephraim and Manasseh in the next section. So I think this part is hearkening back to something that's already been said and done. And then we come to the blessing. But in any case, here's what's happening. Jacob recounts the blessings that were proclaimed to him by God at Bethel, which is referred to as Luz here. It's the same place. And at that time, God appeared to Jacob and made the promises that he would be fruitful, that he would have the land of Canaan as an eternal possession, and he'd be a company of many peoples. So he just revisits those promises that were made to him at Bethel many years previous to this. And then he says, I am going to make your two sons, Joseph, I'm going to make your two sons my sons. So he is adopting them as his own. And they will inherit just as if they were his very sons, like Reuben and Simeon. He goes on to, what he says about the death of Rachel is an explanation for why he's adopting them. He only had a chance to have two children by Rachel, and then she died. And I think he's raising this because he is adopting two more children by Rachel via Joseph. So that's apparently the motive behind this. He's adding to his number of sons, and he wanted to add it to them through Rachel. So it's Joseph's sons that he is adopting. It is interesting that as Jacob says this, in his adoption of these sons, he is adopting Ephraim and Manasseh. That is interesting because Manasseh was born first. And elsewhere in the narrative, it's always Manasseh and Ephraim. But when Jacob speaks, it's Ephraim and Manasseh. He switched them around. And that becomes significant in just a minute. Verses 8 through 22. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given to me here." So he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were so dim from the age that he could not see. Then Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well." Then Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, By you Israel shall pronounce blessings, saying, May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. And I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. What's happening here is apparently a ceremony, and it really makes much more sense to see it as a ceremony. It clears up a lot of questions that are otherwise rather puzzling. So is seen as a ceremony then, the question that Jacob asks, who are these? It's not a real question. It's a question like in a wedding ceremony, who gives this bride? It's not as if the pastor doesn't know. It's just part of the ceremony. And similarly, that seems to be the case here. Who are these? And Joseph says, these are my sons. So it's just a way of him identifying, these are my sons, formally for the purposes of the ceremony. It does go on to say that Jacob is going blind, just as you'll recall his father had gone blind in his old age. But I think that that is a reference to what's coming up and not a reference back to why he's saying, who are these people? And we'll see how that becomes relevant later on. Jacob at this point then recalls that the gracious thing that God did, that Jacob thought that he had lost Joseph forever and would never see him again, that he had died. And yet not only has he seen Joseph again, but he has seen the sons of Joseph. And that is really a major act of grace on God's part that has a huge impact on Jacob and his thinking, and he's recalling that at this point. Then it says, Joseph takes them from his knees. If you calculate the ages of Manasseh and Ephraim, they're both in their 20s at this point in time. So either Joseph has strong knees or something else is happening. And I think that, again, this is kind of ceremonial. He isn't actually physically taking them from his knees, but to have a child, there are a number of places in the Old Testament where it talks about someone receiving the children on his knees when they're born. That means they are legitimately his. So in this case, Joseph is removing them from his knees. They are legitimately his, but he's turning them over to Jacob to be adopted. So I think the language is symbolic here. It's not, he isn't actually taking them from his knees. Then he bows to Jacob. Then he sends the boys forward, and Joseph has choreographed this thing. He knows how he's going to do this. He sends them forward, and he sends Manasseh with his left hand to Jacob's right hand, and he sends Ephraim with his right hand to Jacob's left hand, because the one that is blessed with the right hand, that's the blessing that takes preeminence. Manasseh being the older, he should receive the preeminent blessing. So he sends them forward, all of this very well choreographed, and Jacob does the very unexpected thing. He crosses his hands when he lays his hands on the heads of the two sons. And then he proclaims this blessing, and he proclaims it in the name of the God of his fathers, the God who took care of him, and the angel who redeemed him. This is all the same God, I think. He's recognizing that this is the God with this historic continuity with not only with Jacob, but also with Isaac, and then with before him with Abraham. It's the God who saw him through all of his difficulties. Remember, Jacob said, "My life has been short and unpleasant." And this was the God who saw him through all of this unpleasant life, this series of trials that Jacob had throughout his life. And the angel who redeemed him. And I think this is hearkening back to the time when Jacob wrestled with the angel. And as we talked about that angel, who is the angel? And the angel is essentially, I think, a stand-in for God. And there was that wrestling match in which Jacob came to the place where he wanted desperately whatever God had to offer him. He came to the place where he really valued whatever God had to offer him. And he wanted that so desperately, he was going to pin this angel down until he got a promise that this angel would give him the best, God's best. So the angel kind of blurs together with God in this particular event, and I think in this imagery here that Jacob is using. So it's the historic God, the God that's been with him through all of his difficulties, and it's the God who redeemed him. And he asks that this God then bless them and make them fruitful and numerous. At this point, Joseph steps in and he says, "Oh, you made a mistake. I mean, I know you can't see very well, but I had them so you just reached your arms out. No, they would have been in the right place. You got the wrong hand on Manasseh." He's assuming that everything is going to go according to custom, that Jacob will give the preeminent blessing to the oldest. But Jacob doesn't do that, and the text doesn't explain why not. We don't have any information about Manasseh or Ephraim that would indicate that there is some behavior on the part of one or the other that would justify a change. There's no other indication for the change. It's just Jacob decided. It's just his caprice. Maybe it's rooted in his history. Remember, he was born second, and yet he inherited. And he had to connive, he had to maneuver in order to inherit, but he did inherit. And maybe he just wants to bless number two and not number one. It's just not clear. We don't know. But Jacob knows what he's doing. He has decided it's going to be the younger, it's not going to be the older. So he explains this to Joseph. "No, it's not a mistake. I know what I'm doing. Both are blessed, but Ephraim the younger receives the preeminent blessing." But then he proclaims this blessing. He goes on and proclaims a blessing on Joseph. But he proclaims a blessing on Joseph that really is directed towards the sons. He says, "God will take you back to the promised land, your descendants. And I will give you," and here's the first really difficult textual problem. The translation that I read to you says, "And I will give you one portion more than your brothers." In the margin, you probably have some other options. The word here for portion is actually Shechem. And Shechem means shoulder. So what do you put in here? And I think it makes the most sense, given the rest of the verse, that this is actually talking about Shechem. "I will give you Shechem over your brothers." Shechem later becomes the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. And the northern kingdom of Israel was by far dominated by the tribe of Ephraim. So I think that this is a promise that Shechem will be given to to the sons of Joseph. And that from Shechem, then, they will rule over the rest of Israel. And it goes on to say, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. This is curious. We have no indication that Jacob ever fought with his sword and his bow. The only time we have fighting with sword and bow in Jacob's family is when Simeon and Levi decided that they were going to get vengeance for their sister Dinah, who had been raped by the son of the prince of Shechem. So if you remember the account, they lied to the people of Shechem and said, well, Dinah can marry him, but only if all of the males in your city are circumcised. It's a custom with us. It's got to happen. But if that happens, then Dinah can marry this prince of your city. And he, the prince, convinced the men of Shechem to do this. So they all circumcised themselves, and then a couple days later, Simeon and Levi led the attack on Shechem, in which they killed all of the men in Shechem. So apparently, now Jacob is looking back on that. At the time, Jacob condemned that act as being a rash and a uncalled for response out of measure. But now he's looking back at that, and I don't think he's changing his judgment on that, because we'll see as he talks about Levi and Simeon, he thinks that they are cruel and harsh. Apparently all stemming back to that same event. So he hasn't changed his mind on that, but he looks at that event and says, but God's hand was in that, nevertheless. And there's a sense in which I, Jacob, then, took Shechem by force through my sons. And so what in this blessing he's saying, then your sons, Joseph, will inherit Shechem as the capital of the kingdom of Israel that will rule over the brothers. So apparently that's how all that's fitting together. That's difficult, but apparently that's the way that that's fitting together. At least that's the best sense I can make of it at this time. Okay, now having blessed, placed a special blessing on the two sons of Joseph, now Jacob is going to proclaim blessings on all of his children, and he goes through them one by one. Not quite in order. In fact, it's hard to find what order he has chosen to place his sons in for the purposes of these blessings. And I have not resolved that. I don't know the answer to that. But let me read through the entire the first 27 verses of 49. I'll make some comments, just brief comments, about what he says with respect to each son, and then we'll move on. And this, by the way, is where the majority of the textual difficulties come in. Verse 1, then Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob. Listen and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk. Zebulun shall dwell at the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. For thy salvation I wait, O Lord. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he shall raid at their heels. As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Joseph is a fruitful bough, by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm and his arms were agile from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, may they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. So he goes through one by one, talking about each son, to tell them what is going to pass. These are referred to as blessings later in the chapter. Not all of them are good news. Some of them are bad news. But they are all some vision into the future for each of the tribes. With respect to Reuben, he says, you are the firstborn, and yet you're out of control. You're as uncontrolled as water. And I think that means there's no substance, there's no backbone, it's not principled. And so it's uncontrolled. And as evidence, he refers back to the event in which Reuben slept with one of Jacob's wives. And apparently in an attempt to grasp the authority and power of being the father. And so he's being condemned for that. So historically then, Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, settled on the east side of the Jordan River and early was absorbed by the tribe of Gad and ceased to exist as an independent tribe. Next, he refers to Simeon and Levi. And as you'll recall, there's just the event I was just recounting when they attacked Shechem. Jacob says, they will be scattered. And that is, in fact, what happened. Simeon was absorbed by Judah and ceased to be an independent tribe. Levi, His descendants became the priests, and they were spread throughout all of the tribes in Israel and didn't have a separate homeland for themselves. Judah, then, he says, Judah is the most respected. He's the one who's respected by his brothers. He subdued his enemy. Judah, as we went through the account, you could see that there was moral development that happened in Judah. Judah started out as one who was irresponsible. But as we progressed through the Joseph narrative, there were indications that Judah grew up. And Judah became responsible. And he became a leader. He became, essentially, the leader of all of the brothers. And this seems to be in recognition of that fact. It describes him as being like a lion. And it's kind of tracing the development of a lion from a young lion to a grown lion. And that seems to parallel Judah's development to one who becomes responsible and a leader, but is nevertheless fierce and worthy of respect. Then there's a section here that is curious in that, and it's one that is fraught with textual difficulties, and that's in verse 10. What I read is, until Shiloh comes, let me read the whole verse. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. But that could be read differently, and you probably have some marginal note to that effect. Yeah. My margin has a couple of other readings. But the reading that seems to me most likely is that what's being promised is the kingship will rest in the tribe of Judah until, in the section where it says, until Shiloh, that section could be translated until he possesses that which belongs to him and the obedience of nations comes to him. That what says Shiloh there could be construed differently to mean that which is his comes to him. That is, curiously, that is the way that this passage was taken by the Essenes, who stored some of their texts in the caves at Qumran, so the Dead Sea Scrolls, that they had a passage that commented on this particular passage from Genesis, and they definitely took it this way, that it was predictive of one coming who would ultimately fulfill the promises that God had made, and that he would come from the tribe of Judah. So if that's the case, then this has messianic implications. And then it goes on to say with respect to Judah that he will be blessed with abundance. All of the phrases that follow all seem to be indications of abundance. He ties his foal to the vine. Well, the thing that's pointed out is the foal's going to eat the vine. Washes his garments in wine. His teeth are dulled from wine, and his teeth are white from milk. All of that indicating that there's an abundance of stuff. He has lots of wine. He's able to drink milk. He can wash his clothes in wine. So apparently all of those are indicative of abundance. So Judah's tribe is going to have lots. Zebulun says he will settle near the sea. Oh, by the way, and Judah then became the tribe of the southern half of the kingdom once they divided. And then it's through the tribe of Judah that Jesus was descended. Zebulun, it says, will settle near the sea. And Zebulun's going to be a border with Sidon. Well, Zebulun settled in the north. They didn't really settle on the Mediterranean, but they did settle on the shores of Galilee. So it could be in that sense. It's on that they will be sailors on the Sea of Galilee, maybe what's being indicated there. But they did settle in an area that bordered with the Phoenicians to the north, Sidon. Issachar. It's a little difficult to know what's being said with respect to Issachar. But they settled just south of the Galilee in the most fertile farming area of all of Israel. And apparently what's being predicted here is that they will settle in this land that is conducive to farming, will become wealthy, and in order to keep their wealth, that they will capitulate to the Canaanites in the area and be enslaved by them. That appears to be what's being predicted. There is no evidence that any such enslavement took place. So that's part of what makes it hard. But that's apparently what's being predicted. Dan, with respect to Dan, it's being said, although Dan is a small tribe, it will more than hold its own. So we have this image of Dan being this serpent that strikes the horse on its heel and causes the rider to fall off. So Dan is being pictured as this defender of Israel, a small tribe, but a ferocious defender of Israel, or a judge in that sense. Then after it talks about Dan, it has a phrase that I cannot account for. I don't know why it's here. None of the commentaries had a good reason why it's here. It is very curious. It just breaks in and says, "For thy salvation I wait, O Lord." It is after the seventh son that this phrase occurs. But is this related to Dan in particular? Is it related to everything that's been said? Is it? It just comes out of the blue, and I cannot account for it. As if I could account for everything else. Gad, with respect to Gad, it's saying that Gad will have to protect itself from retaliatory attacks. Gad also settled on the east side. By the way, I should have mentioned this earlier. If you've got those maps in your Bible that show you where the tribes settled, that might be helpful. Gad settled on the east side of the Jordan, just north of where Reuben's tribe settled. And historically, they were constantly subjected to attacks from the Ammonites and the Moabites. And so Gad was forced to protect itself from those attacks. And that seems to be what's being predicted here. Asher, it's saying that Asher will produce food worthy of a king. Asher settled on the western slopes of Galilee, up in the north, close to the coastline. And apparently that area was very productive. And they produced goods that were sold to the kings both of Israel and Judah, as well as kings to the north in Phoenicia. Then Naphtali, and this one, the verse with respect to Naphtali, I found in one commentary six entirely different translations of this verse. So this verse is particularly difficult. But as best I can sort them out, it seems to me that what's being predicted with respect to Naphtali, that Naphtali will be a free and a prolific people. So There'll be lots of them, and they will enjoy a great deal of freedom. One translation of that that's different from the one in my text that I read to you is a productive hind which brings forth beautiful fawns. So a productive hind, so fruitful, and the hind seems to be symbolic of an animal that enjoys freedom. So that's how I derived that. Then he proclaims the blessing with respect to Joseph. And this, interestingly, it is the longest of the blessings proclaimed on any of the sons. And here again, this is full of textual difficulties. The one that I read from the NASB, I am going to depart from. And the reason is because every other son is somehow likened to an animal. In the translation in the NASB, it's the only one where he is not likened to an animal. He's likened to a bough of a tree. But that could be interpreted differently. It could be interpreted as an ass instead of a bough of a tree. So here is another translation, and one that I'm inclined to think is better. Joseph is a wild ass by a spring, wild colts on a hillside. Archers bitterly assailed him. They shot at him and harried him. Yet his bow stayed taut, and his arms were made firm by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. There, the shepherd, the rock of Israel. So it's characterizing Joseph as being like a wild ass. And presumably that's a good thing. And he was strong in the face of attack. This seems to be hearkening back to the treatment that he received at the hands of his brothers. That he was strong in the face of the treatment that he received by his brothers. And he didn't physically fight back. It was a spiritual battle that he fought, but it's being couched in terms of a physical battle. But he was strong in the midst of that. God helped him. God sustained him. But he was strong in the face of that attack. And as a result, God will bless him and prosper him in the future. And that's what it goes on to proclaim with respect to him. And then lastly, Benjamin. And again, this is presumably a good thing that's being said with respect to Benjamin. It likens him to a ravenous wolf. What it's predicting, I think, is that Benjamin will be brave and skillful in war. Later on in history, the Benjaminites were seen as being the most fierce of the tribes of Israel. All right, so those are the blessings that Jacob proclaims. Now, what's going on here? I think that what we have is, well, most commentators say this was put in later. That this was added much later, after Israel has been established and after the tribes have been put in their places and have taken on their characteristics, and that the reality of this later time was then put in the form of a prediction in the mouth of Jacob. Well, I think that takes all of the significance out of it, that this is actually a prediction on the part of Jacob, who is speaking God's thoughts here. That Jacob is speaking for God, and he is just giving a little taste of what is to come for each of the tribes of Jacob. What's interesting about it is a number of them are tied to the past with respect to Judah, with respect to Levi, Simeon, Reuben. We can all see that what's being foretold of them has some relationship to the past. So history is continuing on, but it is continuous. And the past has implications for the future. And what is said with respect to each tribe apparently has some root in the past. And I think what's being indicated here is that God is the author of history. God knows what's going to happen to each of these tribes. And he's giving just a hint of what's going to happen with respect to each tribe. Not in detail. He's not spelling out the future. But he's just giving a hint. Just enough that you can see that what happens later on was what God had intended right from the beginning. It's right in line with it. Okay, I'm going to read the rest of chapter 49. Actually, I'm going to read the rest of Genesis here. And then I'm just going to make a few comments on the last 11 verses. I think the rest of it is fairly self-explanatory. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one, with the blessing appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father. Then I will return. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. They left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mitzrayim, which is beyond the Jordan. And thus his sons did for him as he charged them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, What if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him? So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of your servants of the God your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. Also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years and was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. I know that I have made reference to this passage before now, but I would like to look at verses 10 through 21 in this chapter. I've referred to these before, but this is, to my mind, one of the most powerful passages in all of Genesis. Jacob is dead. Joseph's brothers are afraid now that Jacob is dead, that now is the time that Joseph will get his vengeance on his brothers. So they don't come to him face to face. They're too afraid and he's too powerful. They send a message to him. And the message says that Jacob said that Joseph is supposed to forgive his brothers. I think they made that up. Because Jacob, if this had been a concern to Jacob, Jacob would have told Joseph himself. Why would he have told the brothers to tell Joseph? So I think it's highly unlikely that this actually happened. This has all been concocted by the brothers. And they're trying to figure out a way that they can get Joseph to not wreak vengeance on them. And so they do it by couching these words in the name of their father, for whom they know that Joseph has a great deal of respect. So the message, and then they ask for him to forgive them of their transgressions. And it says, and Joseph wept when they spoke to him. You know, Joseph has wept before, and it seems to be for different reasons that he is brought to tears. But I think here he's brought to tears because his brothers can't see the genuineness of his forgiveness. Joseph has long since genuinely forgiven them. This has not been a charade over the last 17 some years that they've been in Egypt, and he's been taking care of them regularly. This has not been a charade. He has genuinely forgiven them, but they are still nagged by their consciences, and they can't believe that he could have forgiven them. He goes on to say, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? In other words, he's acknowledging that that kind of vengeance, that kind of establishment of justice, That's God's job. God hasn't delegated that to any man. So when it comes to them facing the music for what they have done to Joseph, they have to face the music with respect to God, not with respect to any of us, not with respect to Joseph. He goes on to say, and this is what I find really, really helpful. He says, "And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." The thing that's so helpful about this is Joseph is able to truly acknowledge that his brothers meant to do nasty things to him, and not try to transfer it into something else. Oh, they didn't really mean it. They did mean it, and it was bad, and he can acknowledge that. But the other half of it was all God's doing, on the other hand, that God was working through that whole circumstance. And because God was working through that circumstance, the nasty intent of his brothers doesn't change the fact that this was for good. And he goes on to say, God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve so many people alive. God saved the Egyptians through this event, and he saved Jacob and his descendants through this event. That because of what this nasty thing that his brothers did to him, the salvation of many, many people was made possible that otherwise would not have happened. So he says, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he reassured them and continued to take care of them and reassure them. What's really curious about this is Joseph should be the one for whom coming to terms with this past event would be the most difficult. The victim, you would think, would have the most difficult time. But in fact, it's the perpetrators who are having the most difficult time coming to grips with the past. They're the ones that are still haunted. Then it goes on to say that Joseph lived longer. He even saw not only his sons born and his grandsons born, but his great-grandson born. But he asked the descendants of Jacob to carry him back to Israel, carry him back to Canaan, carry him back to the land that was given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He says, I know you're going back. Take my bones back with you. And that seems to be recognition of the fact that even though Joseph was in a position to enjoy the best of all that Egypt had to offer, Egypt was not his home. That the promises that God had made, those are what bring life. That's where you get satisfaction. You can't get satisfaction. You can't get fulfillment in Egypt. You can only get fulfillment from the things that God has promised and him bringing those about. I think that sometime I would like to go back and try to, in a nutshell, wrap up all of Genesis. I was kind of hoping that I could have spent one session on doing that, but I didn't time it right. So I'll spend 2 minutes. I think, as I've tried to reflect on what is Genesis all about, and my best guess is that the theme of Genesis is that God is the one who brings order out of chaos. I think that's the theme that holds Genesis together. That just as in creation, God created the cosmos by bringing order to this chaos and establishing the dry land and the seas and putting everything where it belongs in its place. And that it's not that's that what God did in creation is just a picture of what God is doing in all of reality. That God is in the process of bringing order to this chaos. And to bring order to chaos means to put everything in its right place, put everything in right relation to everything else. And if we talk about bringing order to the moral world, to moral realities, we're talking about justice. That God is bringing justice into being. And I think what we see is that God is constantly working on that. He is constantly ordering. He is constantly bringing greater order to that which is not ordered. But it appears to us that that's not really the case. It appears to us that in many instances, things are becoming more chaotic rather than more ordered. But that's because we just don't know what a truly ordered cosmos looks like. If we knew better what a truly ordered cosmos looks like, we would be able to see that happening more clearly. And he likes to overturn our simplistic views of that which is ordered. So one of the threads running through Genesis is, who do you expect to inherit? Whoever you expect to inherit, God says, it's not that one. It will be someone else. That what we think is an ordered universe typically is always out of sync with what is truly an ordered universe, and it's that truly ordered universe that God is constructing. And his promises are our best anchor points as to what a truly ordered universe would be like. So the promises become a very important part of what's happening in Genesis. God makes the promises to Abraham. He repeats them to Isaac and repeats them to Jacob. And then they are repeated to the sons of Jacob. Those become the anchor points. Those are things that we know are going to be true of an ordered universe. And God is making progress towards bringing that about. It may be a rather complex route that gets us there. But they are going to come to pass. And Genesis is setting us up to see that that's the course of history, that God is going to fulfill the promises that he made. Everything's on track, and we will eventually have a truly ordered cosmos, a truly just universe. And with respect to us as individuals, not just a lot of those promises that we see here are made with respect to the descendants of Abraham. But God has also made promises with respect to us as believers. That God is committed to taking us from a state of moral chaos to a state of moral perfection, of order. And he has promised that if we repent of our rebelliousness against him, that he is going to bring order. I actually wrote out a sentence, and I'll read it. With respect to us as individuals, if we are truly repentant with respect to our deep-seated rebelliousness against God, he will forgive us and transform us into the kind of people he made us to be from the very beginning of creation. So I think that that's the theme of Genesis, chaos to order. And that's what's happening in history as a whole. And the thing that we know that's coming, the way that we know the shape of the order to come, is by the promises that God has made. Okay, I have run way over time. Let me just say one thing. We finished Genesis. As a teacher, I would like to thank you. It is unique to have a situation in which an audience will listen carefully and attentively and be really active participants in the process of looking at the text. And there are times I think that we as teachers here take that for granted. It's rare to have that kind of opportunity and have that kind of audience. And there have been many times that the questions and comments after have been very helpful to me. Sometimes I didn't allow time afterwards, but people came up afterwards, and I really appreciate that. I just went to a convention in Nashville, Tennessee, for an accrediting association convention, and was struck with my interactions with people who are all from Christian backgrounds. My interaction with them, it became apparent how unique our situation here is in that. To have an audience of people that take the Bible seriously and interact with the teachers is a real blessing. And I'm thankful to you for that. We've finished Genesis. Thanks.